Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast Carbon Offsets and Carbon Compensation, a conversation with Didi Pershouse. My name is Siira Saukas, and here with me today on March the 1st, I have Adolf Ratsch and Martina Nyman.
We're a group of three Hanken students located in Vaasa and Helsinki, and we're interested in sustainability and organizing for sustainable change. In today's episode, we will discuss the topic of carbon offset and carbon compensation. We have a very special guest with us, who we're going to interview later in the episode, Didi Pershouse. Didi is an educator and a founder of the Land and Leadership Initiative, and the author of two books, The Ecologic of Care, Medicine, Agriculture, Money, and the Quiet Power of Human and Microbial Communities, and Understanding Soil Health and Watershed Function.
Carbon offsets, net zero emissions, carbon neutral. These are promises and labels that we hear more and more in today's world. Some of the biggest companies like Amazon, Shell, Unilever, and Google are using offset programs to reach their sustainability goals. These ambitious promises sound great, but as average people wanting to save our planet, we want to know if the promises are true. Do carbon offsets even work? Didi Pershouse is an expert in the fields of regenerative practices, land restoration, and water restoration, but she's also well educated on the complex issues of carbon offsets and certifications. Therefore, we are so happy to have a chance to talk to her today.
Okay, so hi Didi, and thank you for joining us today. And thank you so much for taking this time to speak to us and tell us a little bit more about your work and as well as today's topic, carbon compensation. So welcome, Didi.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
We're really looking forward to delving into your expertise and explore the details of carbon compensation today. But before we start, could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how did you get into this field as well as the Land and Leadership Initiative, and even tell what the Land and Leadership Initiative is for them who don't know yet?
Yes, so I live in Vermont in the United States. I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is a kind of a intellectual center, you know, Harvard and MIT and a lot of interesting thinkers there. and then lived in New York City for 10 years and Seattle for a couple of years before moving to a very small rural community in Vermont, you know, 2,500 people. So I have a little funny perspective from both sides of that. And I worked for 22 years as a holistic healthcare provider in town. So I had a small clinic. For the last 9 years of that time, I was writing a book called The Ecology of Care. And the subtitle of that is Medicine, Agriculture, Money, and the Quiet Power of Human and Microbial Communities. And it started off as a book about sustainability in the healthcare field. And in particular, looking at whether our healthcare system was sustainable in the face of fluctuating oil prices, and what would a actually truly sustainable healthcare system look like, which includes really looking at how do we take care of our own health in such a way that we don't need the big healthcare system except for accidents and very acute things. So, but that writing that got me into the world of climate change. And as I was exploring climate change, I came across a book by Judith Schwartz called Cows Save the Planet that was focused on soil carbon and holistic land management. And that in reading that book about halfway through, I said, wow, this is where I want to work. I want to work in this world of land management and resiliency. And so I literally basically changed my career overnight. I called a friend who was working in the world of climate and said, who do you know who's working in this field around soils? And she introduced me to a few folks. And within months, I had shifted a lot of my work toward that. And I didn't know how to finance that. So I decided if I wrote curriculum about what I was learning, that would pay me to learn. You know? So I ended up writing a curriculum called Understanding Soil Health and Watershed Function, and getting a bunch of grants, both government and private grants, to do that. And so all of those things kind of converged to, because my book then came out and then the curriculum came out and people started inviting me to speak at conferences. And eventually I started teaching online courses, working with a much more international audience. And so that the Land and Leadership Initiative is primarily my project, though there are other folks involved as well. And it is this online and in-person learning systems, very community oriented. So our classes are very much based on discussion and improving our ability to ask better questions. We have an ongoing community of international folks who meet weekly, working with living systems frameworks, from primarily ones that I have learned through a woman named Carol Sanford. You may have come across her work. She's written a lot of books on regenerative business approaches. And and I, for the first number of, I'll just finish with Land and Leadership Initiative. So the other thing that I have done a lot of is policy work. Increasingly, I am being called on for that and getting involved in that. Everything from my very local planning commission to, I just joined as a district supervisor to our regional conservation district, which helps provide funding to farmers for all kinds of interesting projects. And then I was on the Vermont working group, so a state appointed working group for soil health and payment for ecosystem services, which is part of where I started thinking about carbon markets and financialization of nature, which gets into our conversation. And then I get, you know, I increasingly get called on from, like, I just gave a webinar, was one of a panel and a webinar of the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa about policy and finance. And the other big project that I've been involved in is creating a new curriculum that should be coming out from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, their Farmer Field School Program. And it is, again, about soil and water, but in an even larger sense. So looking at how land systems and land use and waters flow through that can actually change the temperature, the weather, the regional climate, and perhaps even the global climate through land management, separate from the question of soil carbon or forest carbon. So more from a living systems water perspective. So that's connected to a big project in India called the Andhra Pradesh Community Managed Natural Farming Initiative, in which women's self-help economic groups have been organizing farmers, including themselves, because many of them are farmers. They've organized 800,000 farmers in one state in India to convert to natural farming. So this curriculum was designed for as a field manual for those farmers. So those are, I have a lot of different projects going on at any one time, but that gives you a little idea of the scope of what I'm working on.
Yes, thank you. That is really interesting. And that's also experience that led to why we invited you here today. So that's really inspiring. Also, as our topic today is carbon compensation, we heard that you're also well-versed in the complex issues of carbon offset and certifications, and also have opinions about it. So to clarify the term, we could start with a question, what carbon compensation and offsetting actually means, and if there's a difference in those. So yeah,
so how it functions. Actually, it's interesting. The term carbon compensation is one that I don't hear that being used in the States. So and that may be just the groups that I'm in. I'm just going to bring up something that I'm just working on, because I think it may help with. I was just writing something for a new kind of policy briefing for that Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, looking at a lot of the different terminology that sounds very good and that we need to look at more closely before we decide that it's a good idea. And in fact, in many cases, I think it's not the right approach. But so the terms I have here that we were looking at in terms of in that field is carbon credits, carbon offsetting, carbon markets, carbon trading, and then the concept of net zero or carbon neutral, all as different kinds of accounting systems. So maybe when you use the word carbon compensation, tell me what you have in mind for that word.
Yes, we were actually talking a lot about this and thinking if they mean the same things or if not. And a lot of, we of course Googled it, and some places said that they mean the same thing, but some then again that there is some small differences, but carbon offset is what we mean then.
Yeah. Okay. So, maybe do you want to go to the next question? Because I don't think I have a lot to say about specifically about defining the terms in that way.
But... yeah, we were thinking maybe how it functions in practice. If you have some opinions or something about that.
Well, so I want to give a little bit of a big perspective before we go into the details, which is that, there, in terms of study of climate change, there originally was a much broader field that was looking at climate change. And half of it was looking at what we still look at, which is CO2 and other atmospheric gases and the greenhouse effect. The other half was looking at what I was just talking about, land use, tree cover, the cooling provided from evapotranspiration, the way that weather moves based on heat domes, high pressure heat domes, and natural systems drawing the heat or cooling from one place to another, moving rain clouds, sort of seeding rain through natural processes. So originally there were two whole bodies of study and bodies of research looking into both of these. And I don't know the dates and exact history, but there's some excellent articles about this. I would look at on Substack, Rob Lewis and another person named Alpha Lowe, L-O, and I can send you those links. They have both been tracking the history of that, as well as the author Judith Schwartz, who I was mentioning originally. She has written two further books, one called The Reindeer Chronicles and another called Water in Plain Sight, that both of which I believe talk about the work of a scientist who sadly just died named Miyan Miyan, who all of those folks have tracked his work some. And I have came to this much more through a scientist named Walter Yena, Jehne from Australia, who I have worked closely with for many, many years, taught together with. And the idea is that the CO2 and methane, et cetera, is really just half of the equation. And maybe it's not even, it's not half, it literally as in 50%, but it's like one half of the approach to look at. Whereas a huge factor of the heat dynamics of the planet is regulated by water as it moves through living systems. And this can be confused with like the climate denial. Oh, it's not carbon, it's water. It is for sure greenhouse gases create our climate. They make, without the greenhouse effect, the Earth would be uninhabitable. So it's actually really important that we have a greenhouse effect. It's a little bit too strong right now, according to that climate model. There are some people who disagree that some people say that the natural effect is so much stronger that if we were to restore natural living systems and green diverse cover across the continents, that it wouldn't matter if we have more CO2. I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. I think there's plenty of reasons to reduce emissions because of the pollutant effect. And I think that the pollutants interfere with those natural systems and likely, the issue around the greenhouse effect becoming more strong is also part of it. So I feel there's plenty of reasons to reduce emissions in any case. So I don't need to worry about whether that's exactly accurate or not. But the problem is that in the 1980s, around there, the public narrative became solely on reducing emissions. And carbon became not like an element of life on Earth, but it became like an enemy. And so everything was about sort of anti-carbon, right? And by ignoring or making the land use aspect very, very secondary, I mean, it shut down all kinds of research. So these big conferences, kind of like the IPCC that used to happen, got defunded, no more gatherings, no more publications of those things. And I think it was because people thought that that reducing emissions, getting people to drive less, et cetera, making some policy changes around big oil, that those would be much simpler than addressing land use. And a big piece was that carbon was much more easy to model on a computer, whereas water and living systems and plant volatile organic compounds are changing every second in form, right? So it's like evaporating and then recondensing, et cetera. A cloud, for example, it's like all of that's going on all at once. So there's no way to model that effectively. So they said, look, we can model this. And it's a very clear, easy ask. We ask people, we'll create some alternative technologies, which will be great for investment. We will ask people to adapt their habits and we'll make some policy changes. Well, as you know, that simple idea that seemed like a good idea has become a huge fight, a huge problem. There are wars going on over this, both like interior, sort of civil and also international. And it has not turned out to be simple at all. But in the meantime, we lost track of the fact that there was this whole other approach, which may be pretty much impossible to model, but it's actually quite simple to implement. So, it's a matter of using cover crops in all of agriculture. It's a matter of having greener cities. It's a matter of, depaving and making sure that water can soak in, that of preserving soil structure so that water soaks in. There are many, many things that individuals can do and that individual townships and cities and regions can do without needing to wait for any kind of policy change, without having to fight against big oil or create a market. So to me, whenever we get into questions about carbon trading and carbon offsets and what's the best way to do this and the best way to do that, it's like we're actually asking the wrong question. I do think that figuring out how to have less pollutants in the air is huge for the health of the planet as a whole. So in that sense, sure, yes, there's still very valid questions, but as the primary approach to climate, I think we can already say that that approach has failed, that, you know, the US is producing more fuels than it ever has at the same time that Biden is, you know, coming up with more and more climate plans. You know, people, some of the leaders in climate are refusing to sign treaties like the US. So it seems like we're really at an impasse there, and that it's like the ship is sinking and we're tweaking the little controls. And it's time to say, okay, actually we need a different ship. And that different ship is land use. So everything I say after this needs to be in that context. I will say a little bit more about the kind of carbon, looking at carbon and some of the issues there. People tend to look now, because we've been so focused on this single molecule of CO2, right? And then other forms like methane, we're starting to look at the whole world as like a carbon accounting balance sheet. And a forest is no longer a dynamic living ecosystem. It is seen as like sticks of carbon. And so what happens there is people say, okay, well, we're going to reforest this area. And they're even genetically modifying trees to grow faster, to sequester more carbon, and just planting like monoculture of trees, saying, okay, that's a lot of carbon. And it has nothing to do with the dynamics of an actual forest and all the things that a real living forest would do for the climate. We know now that, you know, a lot of cloud formation and rain formation and cooling processes, et cetera, come out of healthy, very dynamic forests. And many other things as well. I mean, it's, you know, that's just in terms of climate, right? But in terms of habitat and everything else, there's a lot more going on. So looking at the world as a carbon balance sheet is problematic. And it's even more so when people start looking at it as a balance sheet in which they can invest and make a lot of money.
Yeah, those are actually really, really interesting and good points, and also interesting articles and books you mentioned there. And carbon compensation or offsetting has been up on the news on its positive and negative sides or views. Mm-hmm. And maybe you touched a little bit on this topic already, but what do you think are the like biggest challenges and opportunities in the carbon offsetting industry and in carbon offsetting?
Well, I mean, I think at its best, the idea of protecting existing real natural systems so that, you know, I mean, I'm flying on a plane to London to, you know, next week for a funeral, and I would like to be able to do that. I have very, very close friends, you know, in the UK. So I've seen, you know, it's very rare that you can actually see the exhaust from a plane, but occasionally the light is right and you can see it. And it's amazing how much pollutant is coming out of the back of a plane. So if some other place is willing to do something so that, you know, when necessary, we can use this amazing technology that we have. I think that's, you know, I think there's nothing wrong with that as a basic foundational idea. And I think there's some great benefits to that, to say, look, we're, you know, there are times where we are polluting, and you know, our lifestyles are now at a point where we are dependent on that. however, for example, you know, we can get into these like repeating loops of like the accounting balance for Bitcoin, which is these like alternative currencies, right? I don't know if Bitcoin is one of them or all of them, but I don't follow that very closely. But, you know, they require millions of computers running all day and all night, and even just our online backup systems, et cetera, storing all our videos, et cetera, is a huge, 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 you know, use of energy, right? Of fossil fuels, basically, or something to drive all of those computers. And, you know, when you start to say, okay, well, we need those alternative currencies in order to fund the offsetting or to keep track of the agreements of the offsets, et cetera. And meanwhile, we're using lots of fossil fuels to keep track of that. It starts to get into like a hall of mirrors, you know, where it's like, wait a minute, like, how much are we using to do this that we wouldn't even be needing it? If we didn't have it set up as like a marketplace in that way. The other real downside of it, I think, is, and I'm sure you've read this, you know, the recent articles in The Guardian about how like over 90% of forest carbon credits are flawed or false, or they're double counting in terms of are they even accomplishing anything. So if we have a system that's flawed, then, you know, I'm flying on a plane and I'm feeling good about it, and the airline is making more money because they can say it's a carbon neutral flight, and meanwhile we're actually polluting more then, because we're, you know, we're saying, okay, we're meeting this agreement, etc., but we're not. So a flawed accounting system could be creating a worse situation in that way as well. And then we get into the like social and ecological effects of it, where when we start to see a forest as like sticks of carbon that must be protected, and then you get people with machine guns going in and saying to the people who have been, you know, the indigenous people who have been managing that forest really, really beautifully, because we know that indigenous people tend to manage forest systems much better than anyone else when we look at the results. And they're being told to leave, or their houses are being burnt down, or you can't cut that tree for your medicine because that we now own that carbon in that tree. Those kinds of damaging effects are just horrendous, like really, really disrespectful, and it's, yeah, kind of carbon colonialism, you could call it. So those are a few of the issues there. Another accounting issue in the world of soil carbon, because I worked for a long time and I'm still a board member on the Soil Carbon Coalition. And we had a lot of conversations with people about carbon accounting related to soil carbon, which was never the intention of the Soil Carbon Coalition, was not about that. It was more about soil carbon as soil organic matter that's, you know, creating the structure for a whole healthy system. So, but because of our name, many, many people approach us at conferences, et cetera, to talk about that. And when, I can't remember which COP it was, but when they sort of shifted to like a net, you know, net carbon system, and soil carbon was finally accepted as a source a potential way to sequester carbon, which now it's being called into question all over again, I think rightly so. Everybody was allowed to come up with their own metric, their own measurement system, their own way of accounting for how much soil carbon was being built. And you had all these startups that were going to approaching farmers and saying, hey, you know, if you do this practice, and this practice, and by the way, we're selling you this thing to make this easier. You know, like you, if you use our system, then we'll get you carbon credits. But meanwhile, everyone had a different way of measuring. So some people were measuring like very shallow, some people measuring medium, some people measuring deep, some people measuring this thing or that thing, or using this technology or that. And some people were doing it in very random spots, and some people doing it in very specific spots. And what we learned over many years in the Soil Carbon Coalition is that because soil carbon is a reflection of life at work in the soil, and because soil microbial communities vary, just like, you know, New York City might be very crowded, and then you go a few miles over here and there's hardly anybody living there. It's like the forest, the Adirondack Mountains, you know. The soil is similar. Like there may be a huge population of microbes in one place because of some animal that died there at some point, or who knows what, or maybe there was a very prolific plant growing there. And so there's a lot of microbial activity in some places and very little just a few feet away, a few meters away. And so measurement of carbon is very, very unstable kind of thing to measure. Likewise, even in terms of depth, what some people were starting to find is that as you do more interesting techniques here at the surface, it seems like the microbes that have been hanging out down low are coming up. So the soil at depth was getting less carbon, and at the surface there was more. So, but if you're just measuring the top small part, you may say, wow, we built a lot of carbon here. So, so measurement is really challenging. And likewise with forest measurements, you know, are you measuring just the canopy, or are you measuring the roots, and how do you measure the roots, and how do you measure the soil carbon in a forest? And, you know, and we get into some crazy situations. So in Vermont and New Hampshire, near where I live, at the same time that people are being offered forest carbon credits, the Vermont sort of climate plan has shifted to that we are going to burn all our forests because it's a sustainable fuel. And we're going to get credit, carbon credits for doing that. So completely opposite understanding of what's going on, and both are accepted. So it's a little bit like the double counting, but it's almost like canceling each other out. So there's a lot of confusion about natural systems. And when we start, like I said, if you're just looking at it as a carbon accounting sheet, it's very, very easy to tweak the numbers in such a way that it that it addresses your industry goal. You know, if you own a biomass plant, or you're selling wood pellets from the US to Europe, which is, you know, they're being shipped in airplanes and ocean liners, you know, freight across to Europe as a sustainable fuel. I mean, it's just insanity. And these are the forests that we need here to keep our temperatures. There's a reason that, you know, the northeast of the United States is a very cool, lovely place to live. You know, it's because we have regrown the forests that all were cut down for other reasons 150 years ago. We had no forests here. So you can see there's a lot to think about.
There is a lot, and you kind of went already a bit into this, but there are like some critiques about this carbon offsetting, but if you would like shortly say, is there a way for companies to, how do you say, how would I ask this? Is carbon offsetting just a way for companies to continue to emit greenhouse gases without truly addressing their carbon footprint? Is it just like a resembling a loophole or like a workaround?
I think so, though. I mean, my general feeling about humanity is that all people are well-intentioned and trying to do the best they can with the education and information they have. So I don't believe that people are sort of evilly saying, oh, let's find this loophole and we can get away with it. I think there are some people who have been hurt enough that they're doing their, you know, we sometimes hear reports of some pretty shady deals, you know. But I do think most people are really trying to do something right, and they just aren't looking at a big enough picture to see all of the effects. There certainly is a lot of greenwashing, you know, of companies doing something so that they can advertise that they are sustainable. Even that, though, I feel like is well-intentioned for the most part, and it's just really not, you know, not being like, oh, I don't want to hear that part because we already are doing this and it looks good. So, you know, there's sort of a bit of a intentional blinders put on. Like I said in the first place, if something's going to be happening anyway, you know, if people are going to be flying in planes, and I use that one because personally that's one that I don't want to give up the potential to do that ever again. You know, I have friends who said I'm never going to fly again. That's for me, I hope I don't have to do that. And I only fly like maybe 3 times a year, but it's a lot. It's still a lot. So if there is a way to offset that, I'm happy about that. So it's not like it doesn't serve a purpose. I'll give you another example that's actually not so much from the carbon world, but I think it really helps to see the difference about offsetting versus something else. You know, there are banking systems now of like wetland banking and endangered species banks. I don't know if you've heard of that. So for example, if I am a real estate developer and I want to build a large hotel in a place that is currently a wetland, that is a bird habitat, I can go to one of these banks and they will either protect an existing wetland somewhere else from development, or they will pay or, you know, buy up the credits of a place that has created a human-made artificial wetland that might provide habitat for that one endangered stork or bird or something that has been identified as the endangered species where I'm trying to build. And so I can trade there to destroy this wetland because I'm protecting something somewhere else. And there's a few issues there. One is that both of them deserve protection, right? Especially if we're, you know, there's plenty of land that can be developed that isn't, you know, that isn't going to be destroying habitat in the same way. But secondly, there's an assumption that one place is equivalent to another. And if I am the bird and the frog and the, you know, beaver and the whatever that lives there, it doesn't help me that you created one over there if you're destroying my home here. It's kind of like we're saying, okay, I'm going to bomb this city, but I'm protecting a city on the other side of the world, so it's okay. And it's like, it's not okay that you bomb my city. And it doesn't benefit me that you protected that city over there. So to me, that's a clearer example of offsetting of like, no, it's really not thinking in terms of living systems and how they actually work. With carbon, because it's like more, you know, the carbon emissions are sort of diffuse, so they're polluting everywhere, right? Or if you take the greenhouse gas thing, they're you know, worsening climate everywhere and air quality, et cetera, because they tend to diffuse. But we're making a choice about what's more important or which one to protect. And like I said, then all of this stuff about like, is a monoculture of carbon in a forest the same as a living forest, you know, like a diverse forest? No. So we've forgotten the what I would call essence work of that each place is unique, each process that's happening in real time is unique. This day is not going to repeat, you know, this woodpecker that is doing something right over here right now, you know, it matters to their babies in the nest that they get to do that thing, you know, to survive for the next generation. So that every species, every place, everything, every moment is really unique in time, and we can't just trade things one for another.
Yeah, that was really well said. So what we've also talked quite a lot about in the course is like our future and what is a sustainable future. So kind of related to this, how do you kind of see the future of carbon offsetting like evolving, especially in the light of like emerging technologies and these global climate agreements? Like, what do you think? What's your viewpoint?
Well, I mean, what I'm seeing is that people are getting more and more frantic to, you know, people are who maybe previously were kind of in denial about climate change or literally denying that it even is happening. But more likely, like sort of saying, like, I used to be like, well, I live in Vermont, it's fine if it gets a little warmer here, you know, like just a very kind of naive approach to it. But I think now with, you know, wildfires in places where we never had fires before, and, you know, I was talking to somebody in England who had 14 floods in the same town in 1 year, you know, things like that happening, everybody's starting to say, okay, this really matters. It's really for real. So there's a franticness, like urgency happening that, I think is really winding up things. So there's going to be more and more and more like, just do anything we can to fix it now. And when we get into that mindset, it's very hard to think clearly. So my suspicion is that there are going to be more and more very rapidly designed approaches. Okay, that's not working. Let's try this. And then we have another issue, which is that all of these well-intentioned groups that are trying to solve things are being pitted against each other, sometimes intentionally and sometimes just because everybody's nervous and, you know, looking out their window at the fire approaching. And so people are more and more blaming each other and disagreeing. So, you know, I was at a meeting just the other night, a very, very, you know, everybody very committed, deep, you know, good thinkers, et cetera. And we had, you know, in 1 hour, we got into two arguments about small details of something, but in such a way that somebody left and, you know, kind of upset about something. And so it's like our nervous systems are wound up in such a way that it's harder to get along. It's harder to think. It's harder to plan long-term. So I think there is the potential to develop systems that do make sense. And I think there have been some good attempts, like some of the stuff that's critiqued heavily now. But I mean, I think the idea that something, the SDGs, the no, not the SD, those are the sustainable development goals, but the, in finance, there's like, it has to meet like
ESG?
ESGs, yes. Yeah. What is it? Ecological?
Social governance.
Social and governance. So, yeah. So that was a great idea. And yet it's, even that now is being critiqued, that those are kind of, you know, done in such a way to feel good, but it doesn't really work, or that it's like just kind of greenwashing. But if those were, if there was a lot of integrity behind those, that would be really important, right? So I think one of the questions is, how do we build a society in which people have integrity about these things, and that that integrity comes from a deep understanding, and where we don't tear each other apart every time that we disagree, you know? And I like the term calling in rather than calling out, you know, rather than blaming, oh, that person is just, you know, a racist and this or that. You're saying, hey, come here, let's talk about this. You know, when you say it that way, it's like hard on this. I know you didn't mean that, whatever, but so it's like a real cultural shift. And I do see some signs that that's happening, that people are tired of just the blaming and attacking and splitting that's happening. And it's like a little bit of a race of like, which is going to come, you know, forward first. And is there something that we don't see? You know, I hope that there's something that's kind of like emerging that we can't quite put our finger on yet, but that it's like, okay, they were all going to come together for this thing. And we know that in a crisis, you know, both of those things can happen. You can have people, you know, breaking windows and looting stores and grabbing things and, no, this is mine. Or you can have people really, really, really coming together like, wow, like we're going to figure this out. We're going to share our food. We're going to. So,
yeah.
So we're at a really interesting point in history. I mean, I'm glad to be alive now, because what we do really, it really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And the ability to think clearly in a crisis is like probably the most important skill that we can develop right now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good sentence. Yeah, we will highlight it in our transcript for this podcast. So yeah, I mean, of course we wish we could sit here and discuss with you all day, but unfortunately we don't have the time, and we don't want to take up too much of your time either. But is there something now, like shortly, that you would like to add, something more about carbon offsets, maybe that we haven't asked you, or that you'd like to share your opinion about?
Well, I guess it's more of a summary that I think that, life is more than just carbon, or that when we talk about carbon, to understand that we are actually talking about life, and that we need to keep that in mind. So it's not just sort of a chemical equation or something like that, or a financial equation. But I will say, sort of adding into this, that the idea, it's not just carbon now. So there are now, there was a group called Intrinsic Exchange Group that was trying to start a whole new asset class in Wall Street of natural asset companies. And there's the whole payment for ecosystem services, et cetera. So there's a lot of financial language around natural assets and ecosystem services. And again, if we dig into it a little bit and the history of it, it sounds really like a great idea, a way of getting money to farmers, et cetera, or to, you know, people who are protecting forests. But there's always a question of like, why does somebody in the middle need to be making money off of this? And is there a way that communities can do this just because it's the right thing to do? You know, like the roof is leaking, we're going to hire a carpentry crew to come in and fix the roof, like the community can say, hey, that, you know, this landscape is not working, but let's hire some farmers who really know what they're doing to come in and fix the watershed and make it more resilient to climate and help it. Yeah, sure, that it's actually storing carbon in the form of a big soil sponge that's soaking up the rain and reducing flooding and reducing drought and creating more cooling, etc. So in Vermont, there's a group that's looking at that, at how do we hire farmers as watershed contractors or landscape contractors, rather than incentivizing a stupid farmer to do the right thing. You know, like we were looking at, okay, who really knows how to do this? And let's hire them. And that's something that we can do locally. We don't need a trading system. We don't need investors. It's just something, it's just what we do. Like if I need my roof fixed, I don't need a trading system or investors to fix it. I need a really good carpenter to fix it. And I will figure out a way to come up with that money to do that. So the opposite of that is what's going on in the finance world, where we're being told that if we don't invest in nature, you know, the only way to save nature is by financializing it. And my question is it actually what's going on that the way to financialize nature is by saving it? You know, I think that many of the investors are like, there's a lot of money to be made here. And I'll read you a quote, you know, in Investopedia. Here's a quote from there about water investment. It says, we know water is the source of life, but it can also be a source for portfolio diversification. Like gold and oil, water is a commodity, and it happens to be rather scarce nowadays. So as with any other scarcity, the water shortage creates investment opportunities. I mean, that is just chilling statement, right? Because it's not looking at, like, what does that mean for the world, for people, for animals, for, you know, where everything is just seen as yet another investment opportunity, every crisis, so that I think is, if that's what they're saying about water, then I can imagine that, you know, some equivalent conversation going on. Wow, like this is a great investment opportunity that all of the forests are burning up, or that people are getting really serious about climate. So there was a move to create natural asset companies as a new asset class. And that was actually interestingly shut down by the conservatives, because they felt it was going to limit their ability to drill for oil in protected areas, et cetera. But it was also a place where some conservatives and some like people like me were writing in at the same time and saying, no, we don't want this because we don't want to financialize nature. Likewise, ecosystem services was a term that was defined in the attempt to financialize nature. And ecosystem services are services that benefit humans and business. So it's not processes that benefit the entire ecosystem. So, you know, in English, you know, the word services can also be like a word for prostitution. And so to me, it's a little bit of like an analogy, like that a woman's, you know, can be paid to service a man. And that's like not seeing a woman as being a full participant in the circle of life, right? And again, the term natural assets or natural capital, similarly, it's a little bit like, you know, the enslavement of humans, like you're an asset, you're capital that I can trade, that I can, or that can provide services. And you know, you don't have your own integrity or rights of your own. So personally, I think that some of the countries that are looking at rights of nature is a very interesting parallel to this because it's flipping some of that narrative. It's like, yeah, nature has a right to be protected because of itself, not because it provides services just to us. It has a right to persist and exist and do its work, etc. So for me, I'm always interested in how can we have this conversation in such a way that is not fighting against the people who we disagree with, but where we can all say, hey, we all want to live in a system that does X, Y, and Z, including the animals and birds and insects, et cetera, around us. So how do we do that? Because there is a huge benefit to be had by making the world work again, you know. And I guess the last piece I would say is that there's a term of it's like fortress conservation, that of conserving land in such a way that other people are not allowed to go there. So there's a movement to conserve like 30% of all land by 2030. And some groups are saying that's actually a land grab so that the wealthy, and including some very wealthy NGOs like the Nature Conservancy, that they are basically fortressing off that land in the name of protecting it for nature, which is okay, but that then it kind of keeps human management out and says we get to decide who gets to go there and who doesn't. And there's some pretty big concerns about that, even though, again, it seems like a great idea, right? Let's protect that much of nature. So there's just a lot of critical thinking and deep questions that we need to ask as we set this up. And I think the biggest question, well, it's not the biggest question, but one important question is who is financially benefiting, or who's benefiting in terms of power and control by this process? And how then, the bigger question is, how might we do it in such a way that is really benefiting the whole system, which doesn't necessarily leave those people out. It's just, it's like looking at the system as a bigger whole.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like, and there you have, how do I say this? There's a lot you have told us, and I know there is a lot for us to digest and to think about, because again, I think this was for all of us kind of a new, like, we knew what carbon offsetting is, but more than what it's like, what it can relate to and stuff like this. So it was, thank you. It was really interesting, and it was a pleasure to talk with you, and hear all these different views on carbon offsetting. So thank you for the presentation. Thank you.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening to this podcast episode. As you might have noticed, carbon offsets is a very complex topic, and it's difficult to explain it in an easy way. There might have been some examples that were hard to understand, and some things were quite hard to grasp for us as well. So, Sida and Adolf, do you want to summarize what we learned from this interview?
Yes, as we heard, carbon-related pollution leads to many environmental issues that we have also discussed during the course. These are, for example, global warming, greenhouse effects, climate change, and much more. However, we also heard that it's not only a bad thing. Like Didi said, greenhouse gases create our climate. Without the greenhouse effect, the Earth would be uninhabitable.
We get different perspectives, sides, and even opinions about carbon and carbon offsetting. Since Didi is an expert in many different topics, she gave us a different perspective to not just focus on carbon offsets, but the bigger picture. We also talked about the difficulties of measuring carbon, and like Didi said, carbon is very unstable to measure. did you also mention that carbon offsets can be effective and have an impact if done right by companies, but it's important to not just only focus on that aspect.
So hopefully you all learned something new today. Thank you again for listening. Take care.